Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Sal Licata back on CBS Sports Radio. It is an honor and a pleasure to be joined by somebody who I've become Twitter friendly with over the last several years and somebody who I grew up loving as a member of the Atlanta Falcons, those teams that I cherished. He is star running back Jamal Anderson. Jam, thanks for joining me this morning. We appreciate having you on for a few minutes.
It's a pleasure to be with you, man. It's a pleasure to be with you. What a day we're having. We just got new uniforms out of nowhere. We're all on lockdown. So, I mean, it's crazy, man.
Well, how's the quarantine treating you? Everybody safe and healthy where you are?
Yes, we are so far so good. You know, we're fortunate, and everybody's been being smart in my family, and kids are all doing good. And you know, it's an unprecedented time, especially for the young people who like to bounce around a lot. You know, and it's just with school being out. You know, I got a daughter on the track team at UGA, one that was scheduled to graduate, that's been postponed, and my son was involved in all types of activities that are, you know, so it's an interesting time right now, but we're fortunate that everybody is healthy, they remain healthy, and everybody's being smart. So that's what I would encourage everybody else to do. Yeah. Stay home as much as possible, you know?
And this quarantine and staying home has led us as Sports Talk guys to go back and watch some of the old stuff. Now, the Falcons streamed, I guess, live, and I know you were tweeting about it on Monday, the NFC Championship game from 1998. So that's why I wanted to have you on. We could get into that in detail. But before we get into the old stuff, the new unis, the Falcons released new uniforms. What do you think of them? For me, they're okay. I think it's better than the most recent stuff, but I like your style. Give me back those 95, even 98. I take those unis. What do you think, though, of the new Falcons threads?
You know, I think I love some of the stuff that they did. I like the fact that they're going to be wearing black again. I know what the traditionally came in with the red jerseys and stuff. And I always felt like, you know, the Falcons should have their own identity. I know that original uniform was inspired by University of Georgia a lot, you know. And, okay, I get it. But when I got there, we wore black jerseys at home and we had black helmets. And it was just a different, like, little attitude, you know. And I feel like I really enjoyed those uniforms. I love the throwback uniform. I think some of the other things are going to take some time for me. You know, the wearing the all white on the road and all black at home, that kind of sounds like another team in the division that does that. But, okay. Mm. So they might have been inspired there. You know, I want to wait to see them on the field and let them, you know, everybody's got like this instant reaction. I absolutely love the throwback uniform. They could have worn that with the white pants, and if they can wear – I know they have this rule about the helmets now, which is ridiculous, but if they let them wear a secondary helmet, obviously putting on the red helmet would be awesome. And I think, why would you ever change that uniform? That uniform is beautiful, you know? So some of the – I'm just more – especially with some of the stuff, the uniform creations we've been seeing lately, I have found that I fall back on, like, the traditional uniforms. Like, how can you get any better than that? Like, the classics, man, like, the, you know, Steelers or Green Bay or the Cowboys. Like, there aren't crazy variations to those uniforms, and they just – they are what they are. I don't even love Green Bay's whole thing. You know what I mean? Nobody – green and gold, all this other stuff. But those classic uniforms, man, there's something about them. So you know, when I see Calvin Ridley wearing that throwback uniform, to me, they could wear that every home game, and I'm good. And if they put on a white jersey with that, and they could wear a red helmet, or even if they had to wear the black helmet, fine. So, I mean, you know, I see trying to energize the base, and I'm just trying to be patient about it because I don't love them. But, you know, I'm like, okay, I like the All Blacks. I wish they would have why not just stick with the regular piping? Like, I don't know. The one uniform, the red that bleeds into the black, like, oh, no, you know. And so, you know, it's interesting. Maybe they don't pay attention, but I talk about uniforms all the time. But I was not, and you know, they involved the players, so obviously the players had some input, and that maybe you could see where that comes from with the ATL on the jersey, which
yeah, I hate that part.
Yeah, I'm not a yeah, so I don't think you know what's known doesn't need to be. I mean, everybody knows where the Falcons are from, so okay, but so they're on all the jerseys, and that's a little interesting to me. But, you know, and then you get into – when you start doing that, then you get into the fonts and this and that. So, I don't know. I'm gonna hold out until I see everybody on the field and playing, and then I'm like, okay. Because sometimes, you know, they could grow on you. It's either going to be one way or the other. But Calvin Ridley in the throwback uniform, that thing is beautiful.
Yeah, okay? And the only
and
thing – They should keep the throwback uniform. The only thing that I like about the change, and I hated these, and the uniform change is a big deal. I mean, it hasn't happened in 17 years. I've hated the ones that they've had for 17 years. But the white jersey with the black lettering, that is key. That's what they had back in your day, what you guys wore before you switched to all the red, which I love too. But the black lettering on the white jersey for me was the necessary change. I could do without the ATL stuff. But anyway, it's a necessary change. I think that, you know, like you said, we'll take time to get acclimated here. But anyway, Jam. Enough about the unis.
Blank. I'm gonna be like, listen, homie, I need to be on the uniform committees. Okay, I'm gonna talk to me. You know.
Well, what is your relationship like with them? Because I was gonna save that for the end, but you bring it up here. I mean, they didn't even somehow the Atlanta Falcons did not honor the 1998 team, which was the first team in the history of the franchise to go to the Super Bowl. You could talk about the Ring of Honor and different things like that, and we'll get into your career. But what is your relationship like today with Arthur Blank and the Atlanta Falcons, Jamal? And why wouldn't they honor the 98 team? What are they thinking?
I don't know. That was a weird deal for me. You know, here's the thing. Arthur came in last year, he took over full ownership, actually my last year for the Falcons, but he was around, you know, he was around. I think some of that has to do with, you know, not just, you know, a regime change in the ownership, but people who are there now who have been around. I mean, it's like, they kind of fall back to the same old thing. Like, I mean, the hype video today was Dion and a couple of rappers. Man, nobody cares about them. I mean, I'm just like, dude, give me Jesse Tuggle. Like, give me some OGs. Like, put Roddy White out there. Like, you know what I mean? It was some of the stuff is just interesting to me. And I'm just like, I love T.I. and Jermaine and those guys. But, like, who cares? Like, come on, man. Like, last year, oh, this is weird. Some stuff is weird to me, and you know, it could be, you know, somebody was like, oh, that's why they have bad karma. I don't even know. It was really weird to not honor the first Super Bowl team. I mean, it took the Falcons offense until the Super Bowl run in 2016 to break our offensive records in a game that was, you know how our game was played. I mean, I literally ran the ball 400 times.
So unbelievable.
It took them almost 20 years to do what we did offensively in 1998. Okay. And so, I don't know, it's weird. I don't know. I don't have any beef with anybody, and I'm cool, but there's interesting moves made. Like, you know, last year they dropped the whole Dirty Bird hype video, that the much maligned, and you know, people were clowning that thing. Well, imagine making a hype video telling people to do the Dirty Bird and A, not having me in it, and B, not even having my jersey in it.
Yeah, I think, like, that's why I was
– I literally created – invented the dance and the name and everything, and I'm like, huh? So
it doesn't make any sense. And the other guy is Jamal. Like, I understand that there have been some off-the-field issues, and if you want to get into that, I'm more than open to hearing about it. I can't imagine that being that big of a factor because, I mean, Michael Vick had his off-the-field issues. They wheel him out there with Roddy White, too. And I'm not saying they shouldn't honor Vick. They should. I think they did the right thing, but they should bring you back and honor you. And even outside of that, that 98 team, as you mentioned, I mean, if you're honoring history, the 20-year anniversary of the first team to ever go to the Super Bowl and the records that you broke in 14-2, which they haven't come – I mean, come on. They're not that team's got to be honored there. So I don't know what the reasons are, but I feel like it's a lack of respect and a lack of understanding of the history by ownership and by the Falcons organization not honoring that team.
No, it was crazy. Dude, Minnesota Vikings honored the team we beat like the first or second week of the season. Like, they literally honored the Vikings, that Vikings team. And, like, I don't even care whether there's any beef with me or what. I don't even know. But, like, I don't care if you don't have me. Like, I don't trip. And, like, you know, I've never been one of those people. Like, I've been doing, you know, I was doing TV and been in the media and working at ESPN, Fox, CNN, all these places. And I'm a Falcon. I'm the Dirty Bird. There's no escaping it for me. And so I don't go out of my way to try to be supportive of the team and to the fans and, like, yeah, this is what we want. But, like, when I have a job to do, like, you know, in certain situations, if you got to be critical, you got to be critical. But, I mean, for the most part, man, obviously, I certainly want to see them do well, and I certainly want to see them win. And, again, there's no place in America that I go, any airport, I don't care where I'm traveling, whatever, where somebody's not screaming, Dirty Bird, just in there. So I'm permanently associated with the squad. So, of course, I want to see them do well, you know? And so, and that's my thing. And so it was cool. I don't have no beef or whatever, and I think some of it has to do with, again, like the people who are making the critical decisions for that regime, and some of those people were not around, some of the and they have a different, it was weird, man. There were, I've had conversations with other people who are, you know, Falcons legends who it's just an interesting thing. So I don't know, hopefully that's something, you know, that gets corrected. But you know, that team, our team was crazy special. And that's what, when they were streaming it the other day, I was like, oh, I was actually, I was pleasantly surprised. They're like, oh, they remember us?
But, right.
I mean, seriously, hell, I was like, oh, so, you know, but it's, you know, people forget, as I try to remind them, I'm like, hey, man, you know, we led the league in turnovers and sacks that year. Like, we had a defense. Like, that was a squad, you know?
Before we get into the 98 specifics, there was a buildup to it. I mean, you know, you could talk about your lack of use early on in your career, but once Dan Reeves got there in 1997, you became – you had a 1,000-yard year before that, I know that. But really, once Dan Reeves came there, the offense changed, the culture changed, and people forget that this – they look back and say, oh, it was a fluke, a one-year wonder. 1997, you guys started slow, but you were building something. You finished the end of the year strong. You had a 5-game winning streak before losing that final game of the year. But you could see, if you paid attention to it, and I did because I was a diehard Falcons fan, you can see that you guys were building a good team. Pretty much the same team returned. It may be the key addition of Eugene Robinson, but staying healthy was a key. You brought in Eugene Robinson to help that defense out, and they got better. And Chris Chandler, and you running the football, Chris Chandler making big plays. And then that team in 98, I mean, so you built off of 97, 98, you almost had a perfect year going 14-2. So talk about the buildup to get to 98.
Yeah, so, you know, when Dan came in, it was a tremendous adjustment for a lot of us. We were going from a run-and-shoot offense, okay, to where we were running, you know, two tight ends and, you know, three wides and all this other stuff. And one thing that was a huge difference was just the terminology. Chris Chandler was new. Bobby Christian was new. So imagine me. Okay, so when I became the feature back at Utah my senior year, like the last 4 or 5 games of the year, eerily similar to what happens in Atlanta. But I turned it up and took us to another level. But we were running a spread offense where I was literally in the backfield by myself. So I wasn't used to having a fullback. Like, I had to get used to trusting Bobby Christian and seeing what I'm like, oh man, this guy is like wait a minute, you're my fullback, but I'm literally bigger than you? Okay. So, you know, but I, you know, when he first got in there, it was learning a tremendous terminology. Like, I'll give you an example. So, in his run and shoot, Jeff George, Bobby Aberg, all those quarterbacks, you know, June would call a play. It'd be like 60 Zego sail, break. Okay, that's it. We're out of the huddle. Dan, it's like, you know, King Wright, Trips, Power 36, Nero, Trey. Like, the whole terminology was like, it was like learning a whole new dictionary. So I was excited about it. And, in fact, I mean, I was like, oh, this hype. Well, look what Rodney Hampton did with Dan Reeves. And then, you know, talking about me coming over, I had come off a tremendous year. I was just really getting going, and I was stoked, man. I would have loved – I'm not even going to lie. I know what 98 ended up being and how many yards and everything, but I loved that offense. Like, that was the offense that Peyton Manning and those guys ran. So every time I see, like, look at Edgerrin James, I'm like, oh, my God, I would have destroyed people in this because, you know, getting 50 catches in 96 and having, you know, 1,100 yards rushing and leading the league in averages, it's because we spread the field. We spread the field. We have four wide receivers and me in the backfield. I like those odds, especially if the wide receivers, and you know, you're in certain sets, and then the draws and screens. Man, it was a beautiful offense. I would have loved to be in the offense. Even as much as I like running the ball and running downhill, smashing people, there would have been. So we switched all of that up when Reeves came in. And so then all of this stuff is happening, and I will never forget it. The first game of the season, like, oh, this is a big. I had this big article in SI. Oh, he's going to lead the league in rushing in Dan Reeves' offense. Oh, shoot. Okay, sweet. Man, we went out there to Detroit. Man, first of all, they almost killed me. Them dudes were so ready for me, and I'll never forget. I got jacked up, and my ankle got rolled, and I'll never forget. I was like, I was like losing my mind, and Barry Sanders. I'm like, kind of hobbling out, and he's like, hey, you okay, man? And I was like, I'm good, man. And he was like, I asked him, I never forget, I was like, man, Barry, how do you, like, you don't ever say anything, man. Like, you know, I'm watching this guy. Every time we play against Detroit, I'm watching Barry Sanders, not just on the field, like how he is off, you know, on the sideline and everything. He's just chill. And he's like, you know, those guys, they're either going to do their job or they're not. Well, me, that wasn't good for me. I was trying to get in somebody's face if they weren't coming to play. Like, wake up, let's go, you know. And so we had that first game of the season, we had mirror statistics, 18 carries, 33 yards. Awful, awful. Of course, I'm stumbling through the first several other games. Byron Hanspart is a rookie. Again, we're learning the offense. And we lost a bunch of games. I remember Dan Reeves. I remember like yesterday he was saying how important it was to win those close games. We're so close. I think that first half of 97, I'm almost positive we lost like four games by 3 points or less. Okay. And
yeah.
We lost some leads. And I wasn't myself. I really wasn't. And Hanspard, who we loved, was a rookie. You know, so we were just trying to figure all this thing out. And Harold Green, I mean, I never came off the field. All of a sudden, here comes Hanspard and then Harold Green. Well, it made sense because I was really banged up, but I was still trying to play because I could play and I was still the A1 option, you know, even with those other talented running backs. And so I was, like, trying to fight through it. And I didn't feel good till like, 5-6 games into the season. But we lost some close ones like that, man. And then we figured it out. I really got healthy. We figured it out. We got into a flow with the offense, and then we went on a run. And I look back, and I'm like, we can only take credit for the games we won. So I'm like, man, the second half of 97 through 98, to that Super Bowl, we were one of the best teams in football. But I'll tell you what, if we would have messed around and won those four or five games, we lost by 3 points or less, man. So, you know, you look back and you go, oh, it kind of makes my teeth hurt still when I think about it. But we were able to fortunately put it together and then go on that run. And like you said, we added Eugene Robinson and William White and a couple other key pieces that really helped propel our defense on that side. Oh, and Tony Martin was huge coming in too. I thought, I mean, he had a fantastic season. Again, I get so – you know, because I danced and because of numbers and my personality, whatever, I get a lot of like, oh, you did this in 98. And I'm like, okay, but here's the thing. We had two wide receivers who averaged over 17 yards a catch please go through the NFL statistics and find those guys now. They don't exist. You know what I mean? We had two guys in that offense who averaged over 17 yards a catch, and Terrence Mathis was a monster.
He was a beast. Terrence Mathis was a beast. Underrated, both those guys.
Yeah. No question. And I used to tell people all the time, I was like, man, Terrence Mathis, when I first got to Atlanta, he had just signed. And I was like, God, he reminds me of one of the Sharp brothers, not just in how he looked and how he was built, like his attitude. And that dude blocked. That dude, he did everything. You know, Terrence, it didn't matter how many catches he had or whatever. He was out there also throwing blocks. I mean, all of those things matter and contribute to you know, my numbers, how we continuing to move the ball. It was just the symmetry and the flow and the energy of that team. I mean, a lot of us are still really, really close because that was a special squad.
We'll continue with Jamal Anderson on the other side after a quick break. It's Sal Licata on CBS Sports Radio.
Sal Licata is back on CBS Sports Radio.
I think it's important to acknowledge 1997 because it's the building block to what became the Super Bowl run in 1998, the 14-2 year. But people outside of Atlanta maybe look back and say, well, it's a fluke year, but you just referenced it, the building block. Not only did you go 7-9 and finish the year, you know, winning 5 of 6, won 5 in a row before losing that last game, but even the close losses, the competitiveness, that's where you built the program up, that the year before
right.
was 3-13 to where you get
right.
to that point. Now you're in 1998, year 2 under Dan Reeves, you know the offense. Chandler's there again, another year with you. We talked about the additions, and you guys go out there and really, and we don't need to go through the entire year, obviously, but you go out there and really almost have a perfect season, Jamal. I remember I was at two of those games, both in New York, because you played the Giants on Sunday Night Football.
Oh my God.
And then you played the Jets a little bit later, and the Jets, you didn't have Chris Chandler there with Steve DeBerg. So outside of the loss to the Niners, who look, losing at San Francisco, nothing is, you know, people do that. That was the one loss.
Right.
Really, the Jets game, you can't count because of a backup quarterback. You almost had a perfect regular season. But I want you to tell me about that game against the Giants, because I believe that was the birth of Dirty Bird, was it not?
Right. So we were in – yes, exactly. Oh, I can tell you – okay. You know what's interesting? So you brought the San Francisco game up, and I remember I was talking about Terrence Mathis. It was one of the few times – because we went out there and played like trash the first half and knew we were better, knew we were a better team. And Terrence came in and went off. And it had – when I tell you that this was the only time I could actually recall him going off and like in – was in San Francisco, and we came out that second half and went on a roll. Now, of course, you know, the Niners still had Steve Young and Terrell Owens and Jerry Rice and J.J. Stokes, and that defense was loaded with guys, and we ended up losing that game, but we couldn't wait to play those suckers again. But you're right, a couple weeks later, we didn't lose again, and we're going to New York. It's a national TV game, a Sunday Night Football game, and so we had been calling ourselves the Dirty Birds, and I was like, man, we need to do something, because I don't think people realize how special we felt like we were. You know, we're practicing against each other and the teams we're playing against. I was like, this is a special group and we need to do something. And so it was really part of something that we were doing in Utah with how I was moving my arms up and down. And I was like, hey, man, we all went to dinner. And I remember, like, the NFL Jams producers and Ray Buchanan had been a part of that project. And so, like, a bunch of us went out to eat. And on the way back in the car, and at dinner, I was like, yo, we need to do something. We need to come up with something when we score, like, do a Dirty Bird. And that's really where it came from. And I barely did it in that Giants game, but the very next week, against the Saints, when I broke out, I think it was the Saints, pretty sure we were home.
Yes.
To the left side of the field. Yeah. I broke out to the left side of the field. And when I got in the end zone, I remember I dove and I looked around and I looked for the referee. Never forget it. And then as soon as I saw his hands go up, I started jumping up and down and doing it. And people were like, oh, this, what is this? That was when I first did like the first time in the end zone. And then the one that everybody really remembers is against the Niners. Again, we were waiting for these guys. Man, I remember Inside the NFL came down. You know, remember back then it was such – that was a huge show, you know, with Lynn and all the guys from Inside the NFL show, Nick Bonacani and all those guys. You know, that show used to be – that was it. And so they came down to do a special with us. And we were like, okay, come on, Niners. We're waiting. And, you know, it's not like you're ever thrilled to play those guys, like, because of the talent that they had. But we were excited. We felt like we had a better team, and we had a great chance to beat them. I didn't want to see them three times. You know, we ended up seeing them in the playoffs, which I was like, oh, my God. I wanted to play Brett Favre. I was like, you don't want to play the Niners? I'm like, man, who wants to play Steve Young and Jerry Rice three times? What? You know, and then that defense that they had, man, those dudes were ballers.
That regular season was tremendous. You're 14-2. You had the health scare with Dan Reeves, obviously, going on into the postseason. And look, you know, I don't want to keep you. I could talk to you for 2 hours, Jam, and relive the good old days here. But I want to keep it moving here a little bit. You go into the postseason, you beat the Niners, and then you get to the NFC Championship game, which was just an absolute classic game, and where everything that you worked on from 97 through 98 in the regular season, it basically came to fruition. You come out with a beautiful opening drive on the road against a basically unbeatable Minnesota Viking team, especially in that dome. You come out with a clean opening drive, put it in the end zone, and then you get behind. You show resilience throughout the course of that game. But I want to hear the mentality of you guys, where you know the outside chatter was that how are the Falcons going to go in there and compete with the 15-1 Minnesota Vikings? They were basically the team everybody wanted to see in the Super Bowl and expected to be in the Super Bowl, but yet you guys go. Yeah, right. And you guys go in there as the underdog and take care of them in the fashion that you did leading up to that. How was the – and I think you went out – you were tweeting the other day. You went out to dinner Saturday night with Evander Holyfield before the game. What was the mentality leading up to that game on that championship Sunday?
So, okay, you know, it was like you could kind of see it happening. Okay, I'm like, of all the years we have this outstanding run, of course, at 14-2, you think, man, this is usually home field advantage throughout the playoffs. No, Minnesota's 15-1. Like, are you kidding me right now? You know what I mean? Like, okay. So then we have to go up to Minnesota, and they smashed. I think they played the Cardinals in week one, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
I don't even know.
In the divisional round.
Yeah. Yes. They destroyed them. You know, it wasn't even a game, but they had been in that situation multiple times in that season. Okay, where they were putting numbers up on people and running people out of the building. We had been in some dogfights, in particular, as we just talked about, the three dogfights with San Francisco. So it was like old hat for us. You know what I mean? Like, even when we went up to Detroit to clinch the division, you know, with everything going on with Dan, I mean, it was a dogfight in Detroit. You know, we had to come and dig down, and you know, I had some big runs in the end and the scored that touchdown to really put us over the top. But I mean, that was a fight, and we had been in multiple fights that season. So for us, we had anticipated, hey man, if we just make this a fight, we throw heavy punches late rounds. You know what I mean? Talking about boxing analogies, this is where, okay, we're going to stick and move. We're going to keep doing our thing. And then, you know, they're going to get tired, because guess what? They haven't been in these races all season, you know? And this is our mentality, is like, just make sure we do whatever we need to do, be physical, and come out there and work. I mean, you think about it. That season, I think we were undefeated when I carried the ball 20 times. Although not to stellar statistics, I still touched the ball 20 times. I think 21 times rushing, but then I had another 60-something receiving. So where they were like, oh, we're going to shut him down on the ground. But you didn't. Okay, fine. I put the two numbers together. I think I'm like, okay, I had 130 yards. Whoop, I did my job. You know what I mean? And so in the blitz pickups and some of the things that we knew were going to be, I mean, Minnesota had a heck of a team. And John Randall and some of those guys, they had a squad, no question, on both sides of the ball. Robert Griffith, their cornerbacks, they had a really, really talented team. But this is how we felt. But you know what? It's so funny, because when we got there, like you just mentioned going to dinner with Holyfield, that was the night. During the day, I mean, we had so much time. We went to Mall of America, and we went to the movies to go see Varsity Blues. But before that, because that's where the movies was, at the Mall of America, they have roller coasters there. Let me tell you what, man, the people in Minnesota were like, oh, hey, you guys had a great season. You had to go get on the roller coaster first. Thanks for coming up to Minnesota. Like, it was a foregone conclusion. They literally let us pass everybody and get on the roller coaster first. We sitting up here like, oh, they think this is over. Like they think like I'm like these people think like this is a done deal that like we just came in here to lose. And I was like, okay, very nice, shake hands, hey, thanks for letting us get on. Me, Keith Brooking, Chuck Smith, Ben Huff, all of us, we got a picture, man, riding the roller coaster in Mall of America. I mean, seriously, this and then as you mentioned, Holyfield came up. He was a huge Falcon fan. And he knew, you know, we were at a steakhouse. We had a room with a bunch of us back there getting ready to eat. And I was talking across the table. And he's like, hey, Jamal, there go your pops. And I look up, and my dad's walking Mike out to the ring to fight Francois Botha. And then Holyfield was on the sideline with us. Again, what was Holyfield known for? Winning in those dog fights. You know what I mean? Like, we bought the extra chips, too. You feel me? You know, and so I'm like, that was like the entire mentality. Now, it's weird because that's the first time I've ever watched that game in its entirety was the other day. And I'm catching me. I'm like, whoo, there were some times in there I was like, oh, this got kind of dicey. But I don't remember it like that. I never felt, I don't know, it's weird. I always felt like, man, if we do what we're supposed to do, you know, we keep this thing and we keep this thing. We keep this thing close. I liked our chances. I never felt like we were going to lose to Minnesota.
Was there any talk prior to – because the only time – and I'm watching it along too. Look, I haven't watched it in you know, over 20 years when I watched it live. And I remember the game was never fully out of control until it almost was with Gary Anderson. Was there any talk in the huddle before or after I guess you guys called a timeout where instead of going for it, maybe Dan Reeves would have kicked the field goal with Morton Anderson there to bring it to a four-point game? You didn't. He ended up going for it, didn't get it. Then the Vikings come down. And then you have the infamous, or the famous, I should say, Gary Anderson miss. But was there any talk about going for it, about kicking the field goal in that spot as opposed to going for it?
You talking about with us?
Yes, so late in the game, before Gary Anderson, because the point is, if Gary Anderson makes that field goal, right? If Gary Anderson kicks that field goal, game is over. You guys are down two scores. Before that, you had a chance to bring it to within four if you kick a field goal,
right?
And if you do so, then at least that would have made them have to go for a touchdown. Otherwise, you had another chance. So you didn't. You ended up going for it. You didn't get it. Vikings go down the field. Gary Anderson then misses, giving you more life. Do you remember that at all? That wasn't really. I mean. You know,
I do. I never thought I'm a, even as a coach, and I know I coached my son's team for many years, I believed, and I still do, and this would probably be my philosophy, and I think if you do extensive, you know, everybody's about the numbers now, I think the numbers prove you should use all four downs. I know how traditional situational football is, but anytime I was on the field, you know, and I don't care what team it was, unless it was some out of control situation, I was always about going for it on fourth down. I was like, it's the fourth down, not the last down where you punt, which is kind of the mentality of most people. And I get it. I get that safe stuff. And, oh, you don't want to do this. Yeah. I'm not trying to go for fourth. I'm not trying to go for it. Like when we're in our side of territory, inside the 30, not crazy stuff, but I believe the fourth down to be just that, another down to get a first down, you know? So I never.
It turned out not to matter because, you know, again, they come down, but
know,
in that spot.
You're right, though, but it would have been critical. There's no question about it.
Right, because then if Gary Anderson makes the field goal, which the guy never missed, I mean, that's what you have to feel like, Jamal. Boy, you know what? We're a team of destiny here to some level because the guy never misses a field goal, and here we go. All he has to do is kick that field goal, and they go to the Super Bowl, and yet he misses.
Tony Martin says to me, Tony Martin comes over where I am. I'm sitting on the bench, and Tony Martin comes over to me. He's like, hey, Jamal. He's like, you need to watch this. And because I wasn't watching. I was not going to watch Gary Anderson kick us to oblivion, okay? I wasn't going to watch it. And he's like, Tony Martin sat next to me on the bench. He's like, come on, man, I'm telling you. It's Murphy's Law, man. Nobody could be perfect. Nobody could be perfect, man. I'm telling you, he's going to miss. And he was emphatic about it. And I was like, okay. So I watched, and he missed. And I was like, you got to be, you know, we jumped up, man. It was like, okay, you know, holy smokes. Because the dude was, you're right. I'm almost positive he was either 39 of 39 or 40 of 40 that year. Dude didn't miss anything. So, I, you know, such a nice guy. I hated that for him. You know, obviously it was huge for us, but I was like, oh my gosh. Oh man. So it was crazy though. But he missed, which is amazing.
Incredible win, incredible game. I mean, it's just, and I know, look, I know you got to run here. I got two more quickies for you, Jamal, before we let you go. The following year, because this kind of changes the entire direction of the franchise, right? You come off of building in 97, 14-2 in a Super Bowl appearance in 98. 99, you have the season opener with Minnesota in the Georgia Dome, a tremendous football game. Morton Anderson, I don't know what he's, you know, what was wrong with him that day, but missing two field goals. You guys lose a three-point game. Chandler gets hurt. And then the Monday Night Football game, and I'll never forget, my heart was broken watching that. Second, first play of the game, a flea flicker from Tony Graziani. You guys don't get it. Second series of the game, you go down, and not only, you know, I know you came back and had a good year after that, but you, the team was never the same, and you obviously weren't the lead guy anymore. Can you take me through 1999 a little bit, the disappointment following up that Super Bowl year?
You mean you called it? I thought, I mean, everybody was talking about the matchup again, and I felt like, oh man, I thought we were in a good spot. We lost Tony Martin, and I hated that, and I hated the decisions that were made. But Tony had some other stuff going on in Miami, and I think maybe that was the best possible scenario for him in his personal life, because those things got handled, and I think part of it was because he was in Miami at the time. But I didn't want to see him go. Now, you know, Chris Callaway came in, and you know, he was an accomplished guy. He was like another sort of Terrence Mathis guy. And you know, you mentioned the flea flicker. It was a big call, and it just didn't work out for us. And we were all like, oh. And I think it was the very next play when we ran the draw, and I saw the stunts of the ends and how they came up, and it altered how I was going to move. And I was going to be cutting in the backfield a lot earlier than I would usually get up to the line of scrimmage, and I was going to have to make moves before that. And I mean, it was crazy. I just felt like hey, we were in Dallas. You couldn't have told me that Oswald didn't take a shot at my knee because it was on fire. Okay. I was like, that's all I felt. All I felt was, and I just remember going down. I've never even seen it. Somebody was like, "Oh, it's on YouTube." I was like, "Oh, thanks."
Yeah, I just went back. I can't even imagine for you going back. I just went back and watched. I haven't watched it since it happened, but I wanted to prepare for this, knowing I was going to talk to you, and I wanted to, you know, relive that a little bit. So I watched the end of the first game and then the second game where it all fell apart. And, you know, obviously it was painful, and you can't even watch any more than that. But it just changed everything. It changed what – because I remember after losing the Super Bowl, Jamal, Dan Reeves said, you know, in the post game, well, next year we'll have home field advantage. The Super Bowl was in Atlanta in the Georgia Dome in 1999, and the expectation was – you guys are going to build off of that and get there, and what could have been if not for injuries to Chandler and yourself.
Exactly. Instead of being in the game, I'm commentating and broadcasting for ESPN. Although a tremendous opportunity, I would have much rather been on the field. You know, real quick before I go, the other team that I felt like was going to be good before I got hurt was in 2001. I feel like if I would have not got hurt in 2001, we were gonna make the playoffs. You know, that was the youngster Sevens rookie season, and even after I got hurt, we started the season very strong. And even after I got hurt, I think at one point the Falcons might have been like 6-3. You know, but then it all fell apart. But I felt like, man, and then you know that kind of thing happened with Vic. It's just like this. There's this weird something going on. Like, as soon as Vic gets rolling, then all of a sudden that preseason he breaks his leg, and it's like, man, I look back at the times where it's like, oh, they couldn't have back-to-back playoff winning seasons, or they didn't go to the playoffs back-to-back years, and I could point to this big injury here. I mean, it happens to everybody, but some of them, and in those situations, especially to say Mike Vick or Chris Chandler or me, it was like huge injuries. You know what I mean? And so it stunk. It would have been nice to see what would have happened if we would have all been able to play together. I mean, I've talked to Mike before. It's like, man, we didn't really get a chance.
There are two guys who sum up my prime fandom as an Atlanta Falcon fan, and that would be Michael Vick and that will be Jamal Anderson. You, to me, should be held in that high of regard. And you go back and look at the amount of carries that you had for that, you know, 4 years, 4 or 5 years, obviously the year that you got injured, notwithstanding, 1,000-yard seasons, right. Super Bowl run. I mean, it was great watching. I love going back and watching it again. I could watch you run over cornerbacks and defensive backs and linebackers all day long, Jay. It was a pleasure watching it, and I know we took up a lot of your time, and I appreciate having you on and you giving me the few minutes here and going back and reliving some of the good old days. And next time, we'll talk about, you know, the current Falcons or the years that, you know, like you said, the Michael Vick years. We could get into that. There's so much we got to get to that we didn't even touch upon.
For sure. Yeah, for sure. It'd be good to do it with you, brother. It was good talking to you.
Thanks, Jamal. We appreciate the couple minutes, man.
Thanks.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of 4 amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get 4 iPhone 15s on us and 4 lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto-pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto-pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well-qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.